Interview with Richard M. Phillips, July 22, 2008, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
Well, thanks for agreeing to talk with me.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Turn on my backup.
Happy to.
Okay. Well, this is a good opportunity because, you know, I've spoken with a lot of folks who were involved in the 70s and in the 80s and that sort of thing. But I really want to, I'm interested in getting back to that real pivotal period in the early 1960s that you were involved with. Before I do that, I want to touch on some background.
Sure.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up from about age 8 until I graduated college, or really law school, Plainfield, New Jersey.
Okay.
Okay.
Did you do Yale Law? Is that right?
I did Yale Law School, Columbia, undergraduate.
Okay. And I understand you had a stint in the Navy?
Then, yes. I left Yale, was susceptible to the draft at that time, took a job with the Navy Department in government contracts for a few months until the draft board caught up with me. And then instead of going into the draft and being stationed in Fort Hacachucha, Arizona, or someplace like that, with a young wife, I enlisted as a officer in the Navy, officer's candidate school.
Okay.
And expected to be a engineering officer on a can in the North Atlantic because I have no mechanical aptitude. I hate cold weather. And the last couple of weeks, they asked all lawyers to go to the JAG school at Newport, and we were interviewed, and they selected two of us to be the first Naval Reserve officers in JAG, commissioned as Lieutenant JGs rather than ensigns, and became a captain within 4 months, to the chagrin of the professional naval officers who had to wait 6 years.
Just your luck, I guess.
Yeah.
What kind of work did you do?
I basically tried court martials, prosecuted, and then when I learned where the courtroom was, I did defense work, about investigations, courts of inquiry, things like that.
Okay.
Basically, trial work.
Okay. What did you have a focus when you were at Yale in law school? Did you take securities?
I focused on interesting courses.
Okay. Yeah. So you knew you wanted to be a lawyer, but you didn't really have a sense.
That's right. That's right. In fact, when I left law school, I had taxation with Boris Bitka, who's one of the great tax professors of all time. And I was so captivated by the his method, so I decided I wanted to be a tax lawyer. And that would have been a disaster because I have no head for figures.
Well, what took you to the Securities and Exchange Commission?
Well, came back from the Navy in April. The country was in a mild recession.
Is this 1960?
1960. Mm-hmm. There really weren't many jobs in New York where I had intended to go originally, but then when we saw what the cost of living was in New York anyhow, we decided maybe Washington was a better place, and I applied to the Internal Revenue Service where I thought I would try tax court cases, combine my court martial experience with what I thought I would like tax. And I knew I would get a job. They hired people like me sooner or later. They kept me waiting three months. And then they offered me a job one thing I told him I didn't want to do was be attached to the intelligence division that tried criminal cases but basically held the hands of assistant U.S. attorneys who knew less than you did. And that's not what I wanted to do. And they offered me that job. I said, absolutely not. And then we started negotiating. And I said, what about New York? And they said, can't go there. You live there. I said, I haven't lived there. My parents moved to a suburb of New York after I left the house, and we were living there temporarily. But no regulations prohibited assigning someone to their home district. It's not my home district. Well, it is. Okay, what about San Francisco? They said, what about L.A.? I said, what about San Francisco? They said, what about L.A.? So I accommodated L.A., and then I said, and of course you're going to recognize, give me some credit for my 3 years of trial experience. And they said, we start you at a 9. I said, gee, most people I know get a GS-11. They said a 9. So I said, okay, and I took the papers home. It was a Friday, and as I went to the back where I was staying, there was a phone call from my father saying the general counsel of the SEC was looking, had called, and they were looking for someone, and asked me to call them. So I did, and they said, can you come in Monday? And I said, yeah, and I stayed over that weekend. I walked in Monday, interviewed for 4 hours, general counsel's office, walked out, packed my bags, drove back to New York. By the time I got there at 8 o'clock at night, there was an offer waiting for me, doing precisely what I wanted to do, appellate work in general counsel's office, and at a GS-11. But most impressively was the picture of an agency that could make up their mind in 4 hours, as opposed to 4 months, and not haggle about it. Yeah?
Who did you...
So I never had a securities course in law school. It was given only on weekends at Yale by some migrant lawyers from New York who came to New Haven on Saturday, and my fiancé was in New York, and I wasn't about to stick around. So,
who did you interview with at the SEC?
The person that sticks in my mind was Dave Ferber,
who
at that time was a assistant general counsel. And that's who I work for.
What was the process like?
The interview process? It was a process like we want to get an injunction, and the company stopped violating once we found out about them. And what kind of arguments could you devise? So I talked. I didn't know what I was talking about.
Some of it must have made sense.
Injunctive relief was outside the scope of both my experience and my law school education. And somehow it worked out. The interesting thing was that there were three assistant general counsels. One was a fellow by the name of Joe Levin. He left the commission a couple years after I joined and was in private practice for a number of years. Irv Pollack, who we all know, and Dave Ferber. They looked to me like they were old men. Moreover, the GS-14 special counsels also looked to me like they were old men. I mean, I was 28, you know? And I said, gee, there's no place to go. In this office, I may have to leave after a few years. And by gosh, things opened up over time. The old men left, and they had no alternative but to promote us. And so I stayed for 8 years.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the work that you started in. You were in the general counsel's office?
Yeah. I was in the general counsel's office working directly for Dave Ferber. And I came to that office as the most celebrated defense counsel in the 13th Naval District. There were two of us, and I was senior. So I was highly experienced. My office had no windows. You had to enter it in a little cubbyhole going into someone else's office. And I had come from Seattle, where my office overlooked the snow-capped Cascades. Well, that was a bit of a downer. Used to get phone calls all the time of people, intense people, talking about accounting concepts until they realized they hadn't gotten the chief accountant of Corp Fin.
You had a similar phone number, I guess.
Yeah. And then I did my first set of papers. It was an action that we were trying to get dismissed by a person who perpetually sued the SEC, a fellow by the name of Layton. And I wrote a 20-page memorandum in support of a motion to dismiss, and full of brilliant arguments. And I brought it in to Ferber, and we sat down. By the time we finished, several hours later, it was 4 pages. His thesis was, you don't dignify a frivolous lawsuit by a 20-page memorandum in support of a motion to dismiss. It was 4 pages, and there was only one phrase, one four-letter phrase of anything I had brilliantly written that survived. And then it went on. Week after week, everything I gave him, he would growl and insist I sit there for hours while he tore it apart. And very little survived.
He'd go sentence by sentence with a pencil?
Word by word.
Yeah.
Comma by comma. Okay? And I had never had that kind of training. You didn't need that to be the most celebrated defense counsel in the 13th Naval District. Then one day I wrote maybe a 12, 16-page memorandum on a non-frivolous case, and I got it back from him. And the first 8-10 pages were just riddled with changes. And then the last 4 pages had no comments on them. So I brought it back to him and said, hey Dave, you didn't finish it. And he said, yep, let me see. He looked at it. And he handed it back and said, I read it. It's okay. With a little smile. And suddenly, I started coming of age. And I was there a year. And during the summer, Ferber was in Europe on vacation. The other person who would have otherwise supervised me was gone. And we got sued by by Arnold & Porter on a case involving a Canadian restricted list. Arnold & Porter arguing that it was unconstitutional for the SEC to deprive a Canadian company of their right to have their shares traded in the United States, because it was a property right that was taken away without due process of law. No hearing, the SEC just put the company on the restricted list. Ferber's axiom was you never ask for an extension. It dignifies the case too much. So he had 7 days or a week, 10 days, I think, to answer. And I gathered a group of people, and I remember working for 7 days straight. Those days, by the time you couldn't finish a brief 2 minutes before filing time because you had to type 6 copies, 8 copies with onion skins. Mm-hmm. But I worked over a week, 100 hours. Used to come and get 4 hours, 5 hours sleep with a group of people.
Who were the people you were working with?
Yeah, I don't remember. There was a fellow by the name of Dave who was at the commission for a long time. But I don't remember.
Okay.
They were all junior to me by 6 months.
Yeah.
We put together a motion to dismiss and a brief in support of it. It was about 60, 70, 80 pages brief. And Ferber came back from vacation, came in, walked into my office, which he seldom did. It was usually would yell for me, and said, "Not bad, much too long, but not bad." Having said that, the next week, he'd call me into my office and say, on a 50-page brief, "God damn it, Dick. Footnote 43, I thought I told you to change that semicolon to a comma." He was a tough taskmaster. He was also a great craftsman, you know, and a fine, not a naturally articulate person. Words did not come easy to him.
Speaking.
Yeah, speaking. And no writing. I mean, it was word by word, but scrupulously precise and fair, and taking into account the commission's needs beyond that case, the precedential value of anything they said in the brief. And he did, I think, a great job for the commission. You know, he was a model lawyer and a model civil servant. Yeah, and over the years we had become friends.
At some point, you became a legal assistant to the commissioner.
Yes,
or to the chairman.
To Manny, he was commissioner at that time.
Commissioner at that point.
Yeah, it was one of the first commissioners, if I recall, I could be wrong, who came up from the staff. And he was a very dynamic, strange kind of person to be the product of a bureaucracy. But this was, if not the only job he had, the only meaningful job he had in his legal career, other than selling shoes and things during the Depression.
Why was it strange that he
Because he was a very entrepreneurial, imaginative, vigorous, get-it-done person, impatient, and creative. Very smart, not very meticulous. Yeah,
Not Dave Ferber on that.
No. Very, very, very different. Full of interest on the law, and I mean, he was chief counsel of Corp Fin, but he knew the federal securities laws inside and out. He understood antitrust. He had, a very expansive mind. Mm-hmm. He was a pain in the neck to work for. I have never worked so hard in all my life. He knew no limitations on his legal assistant. There was only one legal assistant at that time. And he had been in Corp Fin, so he loved to read registration statements, which meant I had to read them too. And I used to stay up till 3-4 o'clock in the morning, going to work by 9:00, 9:30, start again, except came home Friday night, never worked Friday night, never worked Saturday night, Sunday start again. It was a very, very hard job, but fun.
How did you land that job?
He asked me. And I think that the Kukatosh case, that was a Canadian restricted case, okay, sort of got my name around.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was mostly dealing with CorpFin type issues?
No, it was a wonderful, wonderful educational experience. It was dealing with all the commissions.
Okay.
All the commissions business. Okay. For example, one of the things that etched in my mind was a meeting that the commission had in this very, to me, a young lawyer, August commission meeting room with a new carpet. And there, the commission around the dais, members of the commission around the dais, and there were four well-dressed, overweight, cigar-puffing representatives of the New York Stock Exchange. A guy by the name of Sam Rosenzweig, who was a partner of Milbury. Actually, he was a very decent guy, but kind of pompous until you got to know him. The executive vice president of the exchange, Bob Gray. A couple of other top officials, other than Keith Funston, who was president at the time. And there was a firm called DuPont Holmesy, brokerage firm, NYSE member, was about to go bankrupt or had gone bankrupt. And the question is, the commission had asked the New York Stock Exchange, what are you going to do for the customers? And the stock exchange said, we're a stock exchange. We execute transactions. We're not responsible for customers of brokerage firms. Yeah. And they laughed, and it was the arrogance out of the question. What a childish thought as they flicked their ashes on the carpet. And I thought the arrogance of these people was something to behold. They went back to New York, and in 24 hours, they announced the formation of a customer protection fund, which was the predecessor, the SIPC. And the reason is, despite their bravado and their almost laughter at the commission's suggestion, Keith Funston, and perhaps others, had a keen sense of public relations. And they knew that they could score a public relations coup and make lemonade out of lemons. If they did this. And that started the customer protection fund, and then as the exchange and the securities markets, a number of brokerage firms, and the standards of membership became looser, the exchange and the industry was successful in getting the government to take it over, which is probably a proper function for the government. And that was the predecessor of SIPC. But I have that vivid memory of that meeting and the ashes falling on the new carpet.
Well, you drew a good picture of the guys from the New York Stock Exchange. How about the commission itself? What was that like at the time? How did these men work together?
They worked together in the most collegial way. They'd get mad at each other, and they'd try and manipulate each other, particularly Manny. Manny was a very aggressive, creative regulator. His best friend for many years was Barney Woodside, who, I take it back, Barney was appointed a commissioner before Manny. Barney was director of the division. And Barney was a truly conservative individual, and insofar as everything was concerned, but particularly regulation. And Manny was an aggressive regulator. And they were very, very good friends, I mean, for many years. Different as day and night, but good friends. And Manny used to plot as to how he could manipulate Barney to support something. and they negotiate.
Yeah.
It was before the Sunshine Act, and the commissioners used to get together and talk to each other in private, not necessarily secretly, but in private. I would be present, other legal assistants would be present, but it was a process of informal consultation.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had great respect for each other. I mean, they'd swear, mutter under their breath of that crazy Jack Whitney, or, you know, and there were two Republicans, Jack Whitney and Barney Woodside, who tended to be conservative. There was Bill Carey, who was a superb gentleman and a almost an unnatural leader. Manny, and then there always was what I would call a lightweight, meaning someone who really wasn't deeply engrossed in the intricacies of the securities law.
Maybe a political appointee?
Yeah, maybe a political appointee. They weren't dumb, but insofar as the substance of securities laws, they were not interested nor well versed, at least at the time they came. And I think there used to be Senator Freer, a wonderful man, who was the author of the Freer-Froberg bill, which expanded reporting requirements to over-the-counter companies. That was one of them. Hema Budge was another one. Hema Budge was the most stubborn man alive. Nice man, but stubborn. And they served a very good purpose. They basically brought the commissioners to reality when it came to dealing with the Hill. Now, the Hill, or rather the SEC, was a very unimportant agency as far as the Hill was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the Senate, the Banking Committee had jurisdiction. The commissioners would go down there to talk about securities, and all the senators would do was talk about banking. On the House side, it was the Interstate Commerce Committee. I think there was a Securities Subcommittee, so it was a little more focus, but they're relatively unsophisticated. And you had the committee staff on the House side consisted of some shrewd old, good old Southern boys. From the time when the Southerners dominated,
right,
the Congress and had the seniority to become committee chair. So the commission wasn't very important. It was a backwater. And when you looked at the newspapers, the biggest case the commission had, lucky to get mentioned on the first page of the financial section, not the first page of the paper.
Hmm.
I mean, the commission, when you look at the relative importance of securities and the commission's function in the context of the 1960s, versus today, you realize something very fundamental has happened to the national economy and the financial community.
It was a much smaller market.
Much smaller market. Securities legislation and regulation was always justified in with the image of widows and orphans. In fact, the people who invested in securities were fat cat, upper middle class and above.
Right.
Yeah?
Right.
And one can argue, if one wants to be a cynic, that the reason why the Securities Act of 1933 got passed in 1933 is that the rich, the powerful, were suffering along with the poor and downtrodden, but their voices were heard first, even in the New Deal.
Interesting.
If one wants to be a radical.
I've never heard that particular pointed out. Well, the Amex case would have made the headlines, would have made the front page. And weren't you coming off that at this point?
Maybe the Amex case did make the front page. The special study may have made the front page. I don't think Texas Gulf made the front page. Mm. Yeah.
Nobody quite knew what that would turn into someday.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Other high points of working with Manny Cohen as his legal assistant.
Well, one of the high points was Manny loved to be an author. And he was a good writer, but he had no patience for craftsmanship. So I used to do the drafts and spend hours or days, and he used to spend 15 minutes, make brilliant edits without detail, you know, without necessarily fitting it in. Go back. We go through 18 drafts. One time he agreed to co-author a chapter in a book, some book on foreign securities markets with Alan Troop. Alan Troop was a partner, a very senior partner of Sherman and Sterling, and also came to Washington in some post for a short period of time. He was the quintessence of the Wall Street conservative lawyer. Very nice man. Very deliberate. Used to drafting trust indentures. Not scribbling off stories.
Right.
Or articles. It became clear after one or two sessions that Manny couldn't stand working with him. So I did it. And I remember going up to New York, and probably came about 6 o'clock at night, and working with him. And we go in the conference room, and there were 8 young associates sitting around a table. And we go word by word, line by line, and Alan would say, shareholders, should that be one word, 2 words, or hyphenated? And associates would give a remark, you know, their views. I forgot how it was resolved, but it was resolved. He would change a word. He would read the sentence with the word in it. He would read the sentence before, and then that sentence, and he'd read the sentence afterwards. And that went on. A kid would make a comment, and there was one particularly obsequious associate.
Well, these were his associates?
His associates, yeah. At Sherman.
Yeah.
It was my first introduction to a large New York firm.
Mm-hmm.
And he was obsequious, and he'd make a comment. Oh, Mr. Troop, I think maybe there should be a comma after the word shareholders. He'd look at it. Good catch. The kid's chest would puff wide open. You know, I'm writing articles, and he's placing commas.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, I never want to go to New York and work in one of those firms.
Yeah.
Now, and looking back at it, you work as a partner in one of those firms, you're in a different position than working as an associate. But I was determined I would stay at the commission. Oh, the other thing I would never do is look for a job after my first experience looking for a job. And I stayed at the commission until a law firm in Washington made me an offer that I couldn't refuse. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened is the commission was a manic, depressive place.
Hmm.
You'd get involved in a matter, and it was exciting, and you'd be in the forefront of what the commission was doing, and then it'd be over, and I don't know, you'd feel a little let down, and depending on how you felt when that offer came in, you'd be more or less receptive. And after 8 years, when I was receptive, an offer came in for the Washington law firm.
So if a firm is smart, it's going to watch you and see when you're back to the routine.
They're not that interested.
Well, some would say that you were working for a really great law firm when you went into the general counsel's office.
Oh, I think so. I think that the general counsel's office is probably the second best law firm in government, the first being the Solicitor General's office, because the Solicitor General's office has more breadth. But the standards in the general counsel's office was at least as good as any law firm in the country. I mean, it's just a first-rate office. And when Dave retired, Paul Gunson took his place, now Jake, you're talking about just great lawyers. Paul Gunson's a friend of mine. He was in my firm after he retired.
Okay.
And he's a great person, you know, great, and a great lawyer. But yes, it is a wonderful training ground, a great spirit. It's gotten bigger now, and there's a counseling as well as an appellate end. There were only three groups when I first went in there. Each group was six lawyers. Then there was a special counsel, and then an assistant general counsel, and a general counsel who was a political appointee. Then, ultimately, there became an associate general counsel. Walter North held that job for a long while. But it was 18, 20 people, 22 people. And they did all the appellate work of the commission. They did the counseling, which was important, more or less important, depending on whether the general counsel had a rapport with the chairman. If the general counsel had a rapport with the chairman, counseling became very important. Mm-hmm. It was clearly the most influential office in the commission. If there was no rapport, then it became an appellate, mainly an appellate and a technical legal office.
Well, tell me about some of the general counsels that you worked for and sort of emphasizing that point as to what their relationship was with the commission.
The first general counsel who hired me was Tom Meeker. And I liked Tom. And he was more of a politician than a hard-working lawyer. But he had a great allegiance to the profession and a great, I think, loyalty to the commission. And I think he had a good relationship with the chairman, but he wasn't there for too long. One of the sparkling general counsels was a fellow named Alan Conwell, who was a fine, prided himself on being a fine lawyer. He came from a New York firm, Wilkie Farr, and also was a sparkling personality. And he and Bill Carey, I think, had a great relationship. And he was a wonderful guy. And then the greatest general counsel of all in many respects was Phil Loomis, who is one of these people who, one of the two or three people I've met in my life whose limits to intelligence and ability I was never able to find. I mean, he was had an amazing, very self-effacing intellect. He was kind of a extraordinarily shy person and socially very awkward. And I understand when he went on the commission, his personal life was isolated. I think his wife had died. And I think he was drinking and all that, and he fell apart. But during the many years he was general counsel, he was relied upon by every chairman of every persuasion.
Hmm.
He was the quintessence of a counselor and an advocate. And he would, I would spend a day drafting something, and he'd come in, he'd take a look at it, and 5 minutes later, hand it back to me, says it's excellent, and make some changes, sometimes significant, dictated. He wouldn't edit fine. He would put in a paragraph in two minutes, two seconds. That would take me 2 hours to draft. You know, it was extraordinary. Absent-minded, he once walked out to go to the Supreme Court without his pants. That's the morning coat. Yeah.
Now, did you work as an assistant to Loomis?
No. I was assistant general counsel. What I did, I went to Manny as his legal assistant for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then exhausted, I crawled back to the general counsel's office and did appellate work and counseling for a while.
Okay.
Then I also worked for about 6 months as a legal assistant to Bill Carey, who was an extraordinary guy. Professor from Columbia, a patrician through and through,
mm-hmm.
who had a rarefied intelligence and a stubborn determination to do whatever it takes. And when we were lobbying, I think it was a Fear-Fulbright bill through Congress, he would go over to the Hill, visit every one of the 50-some-odd members of the House Interstate Foreign Commerce Committee, and make his pitch. And I remember him coming back one day and saying to me, you know, it's just like selling toothpaste. You got a line? I think he enjoyed it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was in very much an intellectual snob, and he viewed law review as the quintessence of achievement, and I hadn't made law review, but I wrote a law review article, a long one, early in my career that was published in the Columbia Law Journal with fellow named Mike Eisenberg. And once I wrote that article that was published, I became up to his standards. Very
yeah.
funny how he revered
right.
law review.
Yeah.
And he was just a great human being who I felt was not someone with sparkling genius intelligence, but with a discipline and a drive,
mm-hmm.
and a clarity of where he wanted to go, that took him far beyond what other people with disabilities would do.
Mm-hmm.
His writing style was extraordinary, very sparse, sometimes three word sentences, you know, and very very readable.
Yeah, if that's all it took, I guess.
Yeah.
Did you go from there back into the general counsel's office?
Yeah,
then?
Whenever I needed a job, I went to general counsel's
okay.
office. And then I was asked by Manny to take over, to be staff director of a group that would do a study of the Investment Company Act.
Right.
And we worked for about 16 months in producing public policy implications of investment company growth. And that enabled me to become the industry whipping boy, the whipping boy for the mutual fund industry.
Yeah.
I mean, they thought that that report was the biggest assault on free enterprise that any government agency had mounted since the days of FDR. I spent 16 months really working day and night producing this report.
Well, let's back up a little bit. That, you know, is definitely one of the big subjects I wanted to get to. Can you talk a little bit about the context? What was in the air that led to something as specific as putting together a team to generate this thing?
Well, when Carey was chairman, he brought in a couple of people, extremely bright young lawyers. One was Gordon Henderson, and the other was Bob Munheim. Bob Munheim, in particular, has gone on to be dean of the Pennsylvania Law School, a distinguished career. And they put together a group that went out and studied some mutual fund complexes. But they made a mistake that many, but by no means all, many what I would call lateral entries into the SEC, and I suppose it's true of other government agencies, make. They have been stars in their own right, and they look down on the staff as somewhat less than capable people than they are, bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm.
And they get sabotaged, not active, explosive sabotage, but they get indifferent cooperation from the staff. And the result is nothing happens. Somebody like Manny Cohn, who for some strange reason loved the Investment Company Act. It's a highly regulatory act. He was very much a regulator at heart. Really was irritated by those people because of the way they treated the staff.
Was this following up on the Wharton School study?
Yes, this is the first follow-up on the Wharton School study. When Manny became chairman, he was determined to get investment follow-up on the Wharton School study. And he asked me to lead this group. The political environment was not good. There wasn't really an outcry for reform. The Wharton School report had come and gone.
Hmm.
We weren't in a period that followed a big period of scandal. So it wasn't a period conducive to reform legislation. But Manny had a thing with the Investment Company Act, the Wharton study, and with his support, we came out with a fairly comprehensive and for the time, radical set of proposals. Abolish contractual plans, the front-end load of contractual plans, put a hard limit on sales loads, I think, what did we say, a 5% limit or something like that, and have a reasonable standard for management fees, and a lot of other stuff that were more technical. And the report was badly received by the industry. On the other hand, some of the liberal newspaper people loved it. Eileen Shanahan was the New York Times reporter who covered the commission at the time. Eileen was a terrific reporter. And to this day, I swear on a stack of Bibles that I did not leak the report to Eileen. But she used to come around whenever she had a spare moment, talk to me and other people. And she understood what we were looking at. And she'd sit down and she'd say, "Dick, what are the alternatives that the commission has with respect to sales growth?" And I would, as neutrally as possible, give her the range of 5 or 6 alternatives. And she knew, after spending a lot of time, she knew this commission, she knew Manny Cohn, and she used to sit down with Cohn too, and she knew where the commission would be going. And she wrote a story for the Times that was either a big 3-4 page story, or maybe it was installments, that got the Missouri School of Journalism Prize. And about several months before the report was out, she predicted 90% of the major proposals. Now,
this would have been while I was with the commission.
This is what?
While the report was with the commission.
Oh, yeah. This was before it came out. Yeah. And it's just a good example of smart reporting and a willingness to spend the time to know the issues, to know the institution. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Tell me a little bit about the other people you were working with at this point. You had guys like Sheldon Rappaport.
I had Shelley Rappaport, who handled contractual plans.
Okay, and he'd been in the special study, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Did he bring any expertise from that, or any ideas on here? This is how we did it before.
Shelley focused very intensely on the contractual plan, and the contractual plan chapter was his contribution. I don't think it went beyond that.
Okay.
But it was considered an important chapter. The guy who was the roving genius of the group was a strange looking guy by the name of Bernie Wexler. Wexler had very bad feet, and he wore high button shoes and a bow tie, a small bow tie, and he had glasses. Even with glasses, he had to lean over the table and look at something at 2 inches from the paper. And he was an exquisite writer, but with a very journalistic style that you had to censor. You couldn't let it go out. And he picturesque. I loved reading his stuff, and I had. It was emotionally difficult for me to calm it down. But once you took a red pencil and took out some of the more picturesque stuff, what came out was beautiful. And I give him a huge amount of credit. I had a fellow by the name of Bernie Garrow, who passed away a few years ago, who was our statistician, the Nun Lawyer, and he did a wonderful job. There's another fellow who I won't mention who came in from the Henderson Group, and he was awful at the beginning. He thought he was going to show us how to do it. And it was a very interesting social study in the dynamics of a group. He went into a funk. It was about a 16-month period. He went into a funk for the first third of it. After the first third, when he realized he wasn't having that much influence, he went into a funk for another third. The third third, he came back and made a really nice contribution. Yeah? And I thought it was just a very interesting study in group dynamics.
You talked about the Rappaport, for example, had this one section.
Yeah.
Is that the way it worked for the other guys, too? Everybody had their...
Bernie, I did management fees. And edited the whole thing. Bern, I'm not sure who did sales load. It may have been Lou Mendelson with Bernie Garrell. I know the summary, I think, was the introduction was Bernie Wexler. And then there were technical amendments and that I think the vision of right. Well, you had these chapters on size. It says it was a known problem. I'm not sure who did it, but it was a small group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've got all the members. We may have gotten one or two additional members for a short period of time, but they were the members who were in the group from the beginning.
And did Loomis just sort of take a big picture look at this from time to time?
Yeah, Loomis really wasn't. Loomis commented on it, mm-hmm. you know, but Loomis was not all that important. This was Manny's project.
Okay. Well, one thing I want to get to is the issue of Section 22D of the 40 Act.
Yes.
And the contention that arose around that. And your point of view when you wrote the report, what your recommendations were as opposed to how it turned out. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we thought 22D had a cost-raising effect. In a way, and it, over the long run, it perhaps did. As a practical matter, however, when you're talking about sales load or 12B1 funds, there are... There are very little competitive forces other than price-raising forces that operate. You have a situation where a large portion of mutual fund shares are sold, not bought. The salesman will sell what pays him the most money. That's too cynical. Because what happens is they all pay about the same. Because everybody who's in sales and marketing knows that they've got to pay what the other fellow's paying. So they all pay about the same, so that the disparity in compensation doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference to most salesmen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not greedy for the last cent, they're greedy for the last buck, and there's only a cent or two difference. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So the natural competitive forces of the marketplace in this instant has a cost-raising effect up to the ceiling, and the ceiling is a regulatory ceiling.
Right.
Now, I argued recently in the roundtable on 12B1 that 12B1 has prevents competition with the sales load, even though it wasn't subject to 22D, by spreading the payments, you can't get much competition if you say I'm going to charge you 70 basis points rather than 75.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think price competition is the real answer to controls over sales charges. I think you have to have regulatory ceilings. Not that there can't be some competition. You can have the discount brokers, but what you worry about are not the people who are sophisticated enough to get the discount brokers. You worry about A, the large group that doesn't use discount brokers, B, the even larger group that is so unsophisticated that they would be deterred by very high sales charges. So if you didn't have a regulatory ceiling, you'd have, at the margin, a portion of the market that would have exorbitant sales charges. just like you have in the mortgage markets.
So you're talking about 22D as enforcing this ceiling.
And I'm saying that 22D isn't that important. Even without 22D, you wouldn't find much competition.
Okay.
What's more important is a regulatory limit.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was some sense that, certainly later, that the recommendations...
22D gets silly. Like the staff at one time was enforcing 22D with the same vigor that they were enforcing a regulatory, an investor protection element. I mean, you couldn't offer a free cup of coffee. But in recent years, they have been very flexible on 22D. They recognize what it is, so that to the extent you've got affiliations and things like that, some basis for offering a lower cost product, they'll find a rationale to let it go.
Were there things that your group put into this report? I know on the special study, for example, there was some provision where, you know, they weren't going to go through the commission; they were going to be independent to some extent. And your report on mutual funds definitely went into the commission, and they looked at it and thought about what they were going to buy off on.
That's right. Although I might tell you, I was at the commission as assistant to Manny Cohn. Mm-hmm. During the special study, and that was not independent.
Mm-hmm.
The commissioners went over each and every part of it,
mm-hmm.
but it was a relatively conservative commission, or a commission with different views. And what they could do, the way they got agreement, was to say, well, this is a staff report. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see how it flies.
People sort of took cover under that idea.
But every word of that special study was reviewed 10 times.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about your study and what you saw as... did you really anticipate what the commission was going to say, or were there things that you were surprised got sort of left on the cutting room floor?
Not at all. We knew exactly where we were going.
Mm.
I mean, not with fine precision, but we knew... when we started, that we wanted to abolish contractual plans. We knew we needed some kind of vague provision dealing with management fees, and we knew that we needed a statutory limit on sales charges. We knew that size was not a problem, then there was a whole set of technical amendments that we didn't even consider at the beginning. But the division worked them up for the most part. No, this was a report that was goal-driven. There had been enough work done through the Henderson-Munheim group, Carey, that at least Chairman Cohn knew where he was going.
How about that? You talked about the lack of a political...
And he knew. He knew also that in the legislative process there'd be a compromise.
You talked about the lack of a political driver, the fact that there was no big scandal.
There was Manny Cohn.
Yeah,
and
right.
He was a political force to contend with.
Were there things that you would have thought about doing had you felt like there was more pressure behind it? Political pressure?
No, I think we felt that the goals were pretty well set, and there was never any pressure to abandon them.
Okay.
See, the special study was different. The special study started out on a relatively blank slate. There was an awful lot that they didn't know about the securities markets. And the great contribution of the special study was the enormous store of knowledge that it accumulated. Now, we also learned a lot about the mutual fund industry through a series of interviews and meetings and all that. But it was different.
As things played out later, were there ideas and things that were raised in your study that you saw? So often we see a study done or some initiative taken, and it plays out over years or even decades. Were there things that you saw in your study of the mutual fund industry that played out after the time you left the commission?
Well, I think that each one of these major reforms have played out. The contractual plan, for example, it wasn't abolished, but it was limited. And the contractual plan, for all intents and purposes, is dead as an alternative, I think a time has buried the contractual plan. And the legislation helped because it cut the compensation to the point where it wasn't as interesting to sell from a salesman point of view, and the rest of it. The bad publicity, contractual plans, I did it in. It's now an archaic way of buying mutual funds. The sales load accommodated to 12B1 service fees and the NASD. The NASD had these sales load limitations. And the NASD at that time, in the 70s and 80s, was a relatively unaggressive and unimaginative group. I recall a client coming in and wanting to start a mutual fund that had a 1% load that would continue indefinitely, on the theory that he felt salespeople should earn compensation over a period of time and therefore have an incentive to service customer. His brokerage firm had a very stable core of registered reps, and this would keep them, tie them more to the firm. So he came in with this proposal. I looked at the sales load definition, didn't quite fit. I called the NASD and they said, oh, there's no regulation. No, it doesn't apply. So 12B1 came in, totally something different from this, what we had looked at. And for a while, it started having that cost-raising competitive effect as 12B1 fees went from 50 basis points to 75 to 100 basis points, 125, and I think there may have been one or two cases more. And at that point, at that time, I was representing the ICI.
Okay.
And the commission started pushing for applying sales limitations. And I think the ICI recognized, and the ICI at that time in particular, was not one that bled to death fighting regulation. Their philosophy was that regulation was necessary to maintain confidence in the industry, and what they looked for was, quote, reasonable, unquote, regulation.
Was this David Silver?
David Silver.
Yeah,
Matt
of course,
Fink.
He'd been a regulator himself.
Yeah. Matt Fink, who had never been a regulator, but they basically and had great support among the leadership. I mean, there were elements of the industry that thought there were a bunch of Washington bureaucrats, but they had the leadership of the industry supported them. So we worked with the NASD. In fact, I think that I can recall coming up with this formula of the rolling 12B1 limit that ultimately was bought by the NASD. I could hardly articulate it because I'm so bad on mathematical concepts, but I had a vision of what it would look like. It's worked, except it's outmoded. It was based upon a study in 1980 or something that said that investors held mutual fund shares for 12 years. They may, if, particularly when you recognize as an exchange, a sales load-free exchange privilege. Okay, so it's complex. It may be even longer. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I no one really knows. And now this the complexity of the marketing, the different sectors, the different kinds of retirement plans. And,
right.
I mean,
the industry's transformed. Since
industry
that time.
Transformed. That's right.
Anything that we haven't covered as far as the mutual fund study?
Well, what you haven't covered, I think, is the congressional fight, which was a exercise in the perseverance of Manny Cohn. Hmm. He was single-mindedly determined to get a bill when there was very little push for it otherwise. He did some outrageous things, like to get bank industry support, he gave them a very broad exemption for bank collective funds. Mm. But it was...
So the ICI probably didn't like that a whole lot.
They didn't like that at all either. But if the ICI didn't like it, Manny liked it.
The bank had the Hill's ear. Obviously.
Yeah. If the ICI didn't like it, Manny liked it. I mean, the ICI at that time was fighting. Yeah.
Okay. Who were his supporters, or who were the people who he was able to work with on the Hill to get this going?
There was a guy, Senator McIntyre from New Hampshire, who I remember. Sparkman was generally supportive. He was chairman of the commission. I had the names, I wouldn't be able to tell you. Steve Paradise, Senator Williams, was also supportive. Mm-hmm. Steve Paradise was director of the committee. And he was a character with a very shrewd native intelligence who never showed it. And he seemed like an unscrupulous Hill operator, but he wasn't. He was better than that. He drafted a report on Section 36B that was pure genius. You read that report, and you looked at the SEC's submissions, and you looked at the ICI's submissions, and what he did was he took one line from each. Every sentence had one phrase from the SEC, one phrase from the ICI, and the report didn't say anything.
But everybody saw just enough of what
right.
they wanted to see.
That's right, yeah. That's right, that's right. And it was a one man tour de force to get that legislation passed.
When was that?
Well, it was our report came out in December 1966, and it was and the legislation was passed in 1970, okay. The Investment Company Acts Amendments Act of 1970.
Okay,
so it took 3 years, over 3.5 years.
Did you work at all on that effort?
Yes, I worked for a time on that. Let's see. I left the commission in 1968. Before I left the commission, I was spending full time as staff director for the Wheat Disclosure Study. And until... And that was about a year. So I worked for a full year at least on the legislation.
in 66, 67 or something.
Right, 66 and 67.
What was involved in working on that? Are you meeting with Senate and congressional staffers?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Drafting papers,
okay.
Writing rebuttals, answering questions. Yeah, it was all regurgitating in different forms, yeah? And I was very skilled at it. I could turn out a lot of paper in a short period of time.
Did you ever want to do something besides think about mutual funds?
Right, that's right.
Well, let's talk about the disclosure study. And again, background to this, what led to the need, the perceived need for this study?
Well, you had a division of corporate finance that was very hidebound. They had developed a set of doctrines as to when restricted stock became unrestricted, when private offerings were being integrated, not integrated, and a whole set of concepts. And as the markets became larger, those concepts became more and more unworkable. I will never forget when I first went into private practice the difficulty I would have in deciding whether restricted stock ought to be declared unrestricted on the basis of a legal opinion saying there was a change in circumstances. Unanticipated change in circumstance, unanticipated time of purchase. And I'd have these stories about cancer. The cancer wasn't cancer there when you bought the stock. I mean, all these things. And transfer agents and issuers would only take the legend off stock unless if they were a legal opinion. Now, there are a lot of unscrupulous people around who have opinion, you know, will travel for a few thousand bucks per opinion, or maybe by the page. But, you know, most lawyers tried to have some standards. It was very, very hard. It was an unworkable test. The same thing on fungibility was very difficult. Integration of private offerings, very difficult. There was clearly a need for reform. That reform was not going to come from the division, least unless you got a new director. But it came from Frank Wheat. Frank Wheat was a commissioner who had been in private practice doing securities work. And he understood the difficulty of accommodating these traditional concepts. Interestingly, and he was a very energetic guy who was restless just sitting at the commission table. Not only that, but he was a pain in Manny Cohn's rear. He knew a lot. He was very energetic. He knew an awful lot. And he would lock horns in a very convivial way, collegial way. This was not bitter. But Manny used to swear, you know. Again, not in a bitter way. And he figured that one way to get Frank out of his hair was to send him off to do this study. It was ridiculous. And he was one of the old-time Corp Fin people. It was ridiculous. Nothing would happen, et cetera, et cetera. And Frank asked me to be staff director. And I agreed. The problem was that Frank was his own staff director. And I was a little too big for those britches. It wasn't all that satisfying an assignment. And when the right offer came, I was in a receptive mood. So I left in the middle of the study. But it was a very interesting experience because, and a very meaningful education for me, because I had never been in private practice. I'd never been in Corp Fin. And what we did as part of the study to understand the problems, as part of Frank's scheme to get support from the Wall Street community, both investment banking and issuer and law firms, was to hold a series of meetings to talk about the underwriting process, the post IPO process, private placements, and it was enormously educational. One of the things I remember most was a meeting with an old-time securities lawyer, a partner in the firm that did an enormous amount of work for Merrill Lynch. Forget his name. Well-known, well-respected. His name was Ivy. And you sat through a session with him, and you got the feeling that what he wanted to do with a prospectus, after putting in all kinds of qualifiers and adverse disclosures, all that, was to take every copy of that prospectus and put it in his office safe. It was basically a legal document that no one read. And that lesson has stayed with me all these years. The prospectus, to a significant extent, is not read, unless it's read by the pros, people who are analyzing deals. Everybody relies on that prospectus as a source of reliable information, not as a source of complete information, but of reliable information, and it's an important document. But where you don't have an intermediary, professional intermediary, between the investor and the underwriter or the issuer, you don't have a meaningful disclosure process. And when you translate that to the mutual fund prospectus, that is true in spades. The prospectus is written by 40 Act lawyers for 40 Act lawyers, and it is a terribly uncommunicative document once you get past the performance table and the expense table. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the summary prospectus is long, long overdue. I invest in mutual funds almost exclusively for my retirement. I look at the prospectus to the extent I do. I look at the performance and the expenses. I kind of know what's right. A high expense fund right. Or not. No,
but that was nowhere to be found back at that point.
No.
One of the big things here is this whole idea of integrating the 33 and 34 acts.
Yes, and that's right. And that took place after I left the commission. Al Summers was a key player in that. And that also was long overdue. Now, I shouldn't say that. I think that the Wheat Report was the kickoff for that.
Mm-hmm.
And Wheat used to make the statement, you can read a 10-K, and after you're finished, you don't know what business the company's in.
Right.
Yeah? Because at that time, the 10-K was almost exclusively financial statements. And that process became enormously important. And the 10K is an important document. Not that it's used by mom-and-pop investors, but it's used throughout the financial community as a source of information.
Well, at the time you're working with Wheaton as his nominal assistant or staff person,
chief of staff,
Was this idea of bringing together, sort of converging the disclosure between the 33 and 34 acts, was that one of the things that was
front
and center?
Yes. And what was very important to that concept was how to get the 10K out of commission files.
Okay.
There was no technology. You didn't have websites. You didn't have EDGAR. Okay? What we were toying about, which shows you how long ago, was microfiche.
Hmm.
Yeah, as a way, as a cheap way to get distribution of the 10K. Until you got distribution of the 10K, you would not have a meaningful integration. But the one thing that the prospectus did was give distribution.
Right.
Yeah. So you needed to get distribution of the 10K and to get a technical means for distributing it. Yeah.
So this periodic reporting can be available all
That's
over.
Right. That's right.
So you were working on recommendations to that?
That's
that
right.
At that point.
That's right.
Okay. Who were some of the other people working on that study?
Well, let's see. I think, Dave Michel, who happens to be a partner of mine now out in San Francisco, who I first met on that study, and he's a very bright young lawyer from CorpFin. I think Dick Rowe was Wheat's assistant, and he was very active in it. He's a very, very bright guy, one of these people who has never said a stupid thing in his life. He doesn't talk much, but when he does talk, you listen to him. You might know him from the historical
side.
Yeah,
I've met him, yeah.
I think Bernie Wexler was in it. And I'm not sure who else. It wasn't as close a group as that group that we had at the 40 Act.
Why not?
Because I think it was dominated by Frank. Frank was wrote every word of it.
So it was a lot of people working for Frank Wheat rather than a team.
He was a very capable, very dynamic guy. And he was into it. And maybe it did get him out of Manny's hair on other things.
Yeah, that was my question.
But as time went on, Manny began to realize that this was taking on a life of its own. And he was denigrating it at the beginning, saying nothing's going to happen. But he's a very smart political guy, okay? And he began to see, and I think became convinced, that there was some merit to it. But it was he went down slowly.
Well, is there anything about your career with the SEC that we haven't touched on?
Let me mention this. Got to realize that the commission wasn't as important then as it is today. That, the Texas Gulf sulfur case was a big deal. But you just couldn't get much focus from the press on the commission, and it was a narrow agency. And the sad thing is that as I look at the position of the commission vis-a-vis the mortgage debt crisis, it's back, relatively speaking, where it was.
Right.
And what it needs is a aggressive, regulatory-minded chair with support from the White House, so that it will take the lead. The Federal Reserve will never fill that role, but it may well be in the next administration. That's what's going to happen. Yeah. But Chris Cox, who I think started off doing a very capable job, was never able to deal with Atkins. And I think he's checked out to a large extent. And, I mean, it's kind of sad to see this tertiary role, if you will, that the commission is playing. And that was its role back when I started. Okay. It was the banking agencies.
Right.
Saxon was the reformer, the control of the currency. The Federal Reserve was the staid, steady regulator.
That's interesting.
And so I think you see in a much larger canvas, because the economy has grown, the financial community has grown, the world of investors and flow of money has grown, you see the wheel turning back.
And this is a much greater upheaval today, too.
Yes, it is.
As far as what's happening.
Oh, yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it is.
Well, you went into private practice after you left the SEC?
Yes.
Okay, and I think I saw somewhere that you were associated with the mutual fund industry. Is that right? Was that a specialty?
Yes. Well, yes and no. When I went into the commission, there's a couple of very interesting times. When I left the commission and I went to work for a firm called Surrey Curassic Green and Hill. It was dominated by a fellow named Walter Surrey, who was the brother of Stan Surrey, who was Assistant Secretary of State, a noted tax expert. Walter was a very dynamic character, international lawyer, who loved law practice for the excitement and had no sense of economics. And he would pull in these group of very interesting people who had foreign service, some kind of foreign service connection, who didn't know beans about practicing law. And I came in as a nominal partner at the salary, at the guaranteed salary of $25,000 a year, which, after a pay raise that took effect shortly after I left, was about $3,000 more than I would have made if I stayed at the commission. Private practice, and this is very important, at that time paid a little better, but not much better, and you had to buy suits and have regular haircuts, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So the competition of private practice in terms of dollars wasn't all that significant. Yeah, there was no ceiling, the ceiling was much higher. But what you made at the beginning, in the first year or two, three, was not that much more.
So it would have been a little easier for the SEC to keep people at that point.
Absolutely, and I didn't leave to make more money. I left because I wanted. I was in my depressive state, and an interesting offer came. So I was the first securities lawyer in this law firm. That was a bunch of really bright ragtag collection of individuals who were doing different things, and Walter Surrey again was a very dynamic guy. And if there was anything public, he would give it to me. And I was doing tax work because it was a tax on public companies. In those days, there weren't many securities lawyers in Washington. I can tell you who they were. Milk Kroll, Kroll, Levy, and Simon had a boutique. Arlen Porter did some enforcement work. Hogan and Hartson represented the gas company and Woodward and Northrop and a couple of others, good corporate clients. Covington felt that securities practice was beneath them. There was a bunch of prospectus writers. That was Dean Acheson's view. Aaron Fox did some real estate syndications. And, you know, there wasn't much more. I remember I was doing 10-Ks for a company in Florida outside of Steel Hector and a couple of firms in Miami. There were no securities lawyers. There was a defrock broker deal who was a securities lawyer. I mean, it was a very small community. I used to say, if someone says they were a securities lawyer, and I didn't know him, he was a lawyer.
Yeah. When did that change?
It changed, I think, rapidly in the 70s and really in the 80s. It's a function of the growth of the markets, the growth of public companies, the growth of the investing public, retirement plans, the change from fixed benefit to fixed contribution plan, defined benefit, you know, and a multitude of factors. But it was a different world then, and I did everything, and I, you know. Did enforcement. I did 10-Ks. I did acquisitions and then de-acquisitions when the bloom was off the rose. M&A work and things like that. And then two things happened. There was a fella who was general counsel of IDS and Diversified Services, which at that time was one of the largest mutual fund complexes. And it was a subsidiary of Allegheny Holding Company. He was general counsel as Bob Leffler. And Jefferies and Company, a broker dealer, an institutional broker dealer was acquired by IDS. And Jefferies became affiliated with a mutual fund conference, and with a mutual fund complex. And the New York Stock Exchange had a rule, the so-called parent rule, that said any brokerage firm affiliated with a institution cannot be a member of the exchange. It was an anti-competitive rule designed to prevent easy evasion of the fixed commission rate. And on Labor Day, and Bob Leffler was very active in the ICI on the legislation opposing the commission. And I was butting heads with him. And it was, and I had, oh, I know what happened. I had left Surrey Curassic. 13 of us left to start our own law firm. We bought for $15,000 a whole suite of 12 offices, fully furnished, took over the lease with a law library, from Saxon, former controller of the currency, a guy named McGuire, who was a bag man for the Kennedys. He was in the White House as an assistant, and some other well-known member of the Kennedy administration. They had gone into practice, furnished this place up very nicely, and fell on their face. So we took it over, 13 of us, and we had room for about 15, 16. And I had one client. It was Flaw's ladies' shops that wanted to go public with what I would call a low-end broker-dealer in Albany, New York. That was my only client. Hill, Christopher, and Phillips was the name of the firm. Hill had a government contracts practice, including Bethlehem Steel for shipyard contracts, and George was in the savings and loan world, George Christopher. And so I did this IPO, battling off a second cousin of the proprietor, who just got out of law school. Why can't it stay in the family? And then, I had no other business. And then, Labor Day, I got this call from Bob Leffler saying that they're about to sue, or they sued, the New York Stock Exchange on antitrust grounds. And their regular law firm, Dunham & Leisure, is handling it in New York. But they wanted somebody in Washington because they think that the commission may assert a primary jurisdiction over the issue. And in any event, there was going to be activity on the Hill. Mm-hmm. And that, I said, sure. And that was one of the greatest relationships I've had over the years, long after he left IDS. But we worked steadily for a month, about six people in our 13-man firm. There was plenty of capacity. And we came up with this brief for the commission, I think it was, arguing they had primary jurisdiction. And it was submitted in response to a commission release invitation for comments. And I remember we had a draft, and Leffler came down, and he couldn't stop saying what a terrific document it was. Then we spent the next week working each word. He was a perfectionist, like
you've been through this,
like Ferber, but much nicer. And he never got up before, never got into the office before 12. And we never left the office until 12, where we'd go over to the Madison Hotel, which knew him, and we'd start drinking. And he loved to drink. And finally, someone would say, how about some food? And the kitchen would stay open for us. There were about 8-10 people. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd struggle. I'd straggle home, go to bed, get 6 hours sleep, come back, handle my other client in the morning, fix up the comments that, and start working again. At the end of the week, we submitted it, and it was reprinted by the Harvard Business School as one of their case studies. Yeah, and it became sort of the knockout document in that comment process. And from that, and then I spent about a year and a half, 2 years on it. And the New York Stock Exchange finally caved in. And then by the time they caved in, Jeffries decided he didn't want to be a member of the Stock Exchange.
When did you...
That was a great experience. Then there was a second great experience. A couple of years later, the ICI came to me and said that they want to oppose an attempt by the insurance industry to get a blanket exemption for variable life insurance. And they have insurance company members, so they didn't want to take the lead. They would oppose it, but they didn't want to be the heavies. And there was a group of funds headed by Jack Bogle of Wellington.
Vanguard.
Of Wellington. This was before Vanguard. That's okay. The third story. who would hire me. And so I had a glorious 6 months fighting the insurance industry. And the insurance industry thinks in long timelines. To this day, it took 20 years before I ever had a life insurance client.
Wow. They remembered.
They remembered. Unlike the mutual fund industry, which thinks a long-term investment is 6 months. They have a 20-year timeline.
Wow.
It was great publicity. There was a woman who worked for one of the trade rags, a reporter, and she fell in love, not with me, but with our position. And every day she used to print stories. Dick Phillips did this, I mean, it was the best publicity I've ever had. It was like having my own press agent. I mean, no one ever accused me of sleeping with her, but I couldn't have done better if I had.
Yeah.
In any event, we finished it, we briefed it, went to the commission. Oh, went to the staff. And the staff wrote a 100-page report supporting us, denying the exemption. They wanted a complete exemption. Then went to the commission. And the commission was headed by the guy who was at CIA.
Casey.
And Casey didn't understand the limits of the process. And they wrote a 12-page opinion reversing the staff. And we appealed to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. At that time, we had many years of Democratic presidents, so the Court of Appeals was a liberal court. Okay? And while the government could do no wrong, the government never granted exemptions. This was an exemption. Okay? Now it's the other way around. You know.
Right.
And I've never forgiven Jake Stillman for this. I was going on vacation, and he was supposed to get his brief in. And I remember calling him and say, "Hey, Jake, I'm going on vacation, and are you going to get your brief in on time?" And he said, yeah. And I worked around the clock that last week to get a rebuttal ready. And the last day, I got a call that the new commission, Ray Garrett, had reversed itself. And they were going to withdraw the appeal. and they were going to withdraw their opinion. And so I was proud to have set back the cause of variable life insurance for 20 years.
So you said you had some involvement with Vanguard, is that right?
Yeah. The third thing was, after that, I started doing work for Wellington. I became friends with the general counsel, who was a Bostonian, but had moved to Philadelphia. And then there was a falling out between the Wellington group in Philadelphia and the Thorndike, Payne, and Lewis group in Boston, which had merged into Wellington at the behest of Walter Morgan, its founder, because Jack Bogle had about two heart attacks at the age of 34, and he was worried about the future of the firm. Thorndike, Payne, and Lewis were fundamental stock pickers of the highest caliber. Bogle was an indexer, even then. A closet indexer, but an indexer. They got along like oil and water. And trouble started breaking out. And I remember Jim Walters, who was general counsel, calling me and said, "Dick, I'm in the middle here, and someone's got to keep the firm together, and I want you to help me." I said, "Sure." Within 2 weeks, it was evident that in civil war, you cannot stay in the middle. And Jim went back to Boston, and I was hired by the Thorndike group. And that was also a memorable experience, where they had control of Wellington Management Company, but Bogle had control of the Wellington Fund boards. So Bogle decides to internalize the administration. Just the administration, although there was a plan to take over distribution. And Wellington fought it. And I would turn out these briefs to submit to the board of directors working all night. Again, it was a great experience. We're working with a great group of people. And in Bogle's eyes, to this day, I'm public enemy number one. it was interesting. But I never believed that Bogle could pull off what he's done. Because Bogle at that time was the most arrogant, self-centered, brilliant guy. I never thought he could build an organization. Mm-hmm. And he did, and he built an organization with a great esprit de corps. Something happened. Whatever talent was needed to build an organization, it came out of him. I didn't see it in dealing with him. Yeah.
Interesting.
And he would get on the, go down to the phone bank once a month, insist that all the executives do it, and he did all the right things to build a great organization. He didn't know how to let go.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and he had this one really good idea, I guess, that organized the whole thing.
You mean?
The indexing.
The indexing, yeah.
Yeah.
And at the same time, after a while, Wellington, with me in the background, made peace. Hmm. And they're still their largest client. And they do a lot of the actively managed funds.
When did you go to Kirkpatrick and Lockhart then?
We merged into Kirkpatrick and Lockhart after 10 years. When we looked around and we had the misguided conception that we knew that the national law firms were coming into being. And we had the misguided conception that if we were to hook up with an out-of-town large firm, we could get lots of business from them. But we didn't want to hook up with a law factory, and particularly a bunch of arrogant New Yorkers who thought that Washington lawyers at the time, which is all they regarded them, were a bunch of door openers. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up merging with this Pittsburgh firm of 90 people, second largest firm in Pittsburgh, under all kinds of assurances of autonomy. And it's been a great relationship. But it was a mistaken premise.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is, this firm had two kinds of lawyers, business lawyers and litigators. And they had the impression that anything a New York or Washington law firm could do, they could do at least as well and a lot cheaper. And if they get a securities problem, they'd send someone to the library. Yeah. So there was no referral work during those first 10 years or more. But what enabled us to do was to say, oh, Kirkpatrick, yeah, we did a deal with them a couple years ago. Good firm. It was a quality law firm and a collegial law firm. And it enabled us to move from a 32-33 man firm and to grow over the years. And they were good people. Now, of course, the firm is 1,400.
Right.
I was instrumental in building the Washington practice. But I have no empire building ambitions. And 8 years ago, I moved to San Francisco because two of my three kids were there.
Okay.
And I'm still practicing at reduced speed, about the same thing I did here, and having a good time.
And mostly securities work at this point?
Yeah, it's mostly it is securities work, but it's not 33 Act work. It's a combination of investment company and enforcement.
Okay.
And the enforcement may not be related. And some litigation, but I don't litigate, but I structure and I strategize. But it's the same practice I had here in the last 20 years from where I moved away from being a jack of all trades with the word security in it to largely investment management and 40 Act. But investment management has gotten so specialized and complex. There's ETFs and hedge funds and all kinds of other instruments, you know?
Right.
And I just do more general things.
Well, that study that you were involved with for it seemed like such a long time never quite went away then, the whole idea of investment management and mutual funds.
Oh, no. You lived with. Oh, no. That's right. I never dreamt that I would hook on to. And, you know, I had one of the largest securities practices in Washington because I happened to be in the right place at the right time. Yeah.
Well, anything else that we should cover at this point?
I think we covered it.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Okay.